I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. If there was any doubt about the hold of the political right in the heartland, then wonder no more. A recent survey shows Kansas has the most conservative congressional delegation in the nation. Though the findings weren't surprising, they serve as a strong indicator for the future of politics in the Sunflower State. Today we gather the political pundits for a look at how these four representatives are able to consistently vote conservative, even to the point of bucking the Republican leadership. We'll also take a look at happenings across the state line where the Missouri legislature struggles to find an acceptable budget, has voided seniority as a means for teachers to keep their jobs, and where one of their own voiced his opposition to a bill by coming out. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Did you hear the news? Kansas's congressional delegation is the most conservative in the nation. We'll talk about that today with our political pundits, and we'll also talk about these very critical days in the administration of Governor Sam Brownback. In Missouri, three Republicans are in the hunt for the right to take on Democratic incumbent Claire McCaskill this fall. Governor Jay Nixon is seeking a second term, and State Representative Zach Wyatt just announced that he was gay in protest of the Don't Say Gay bill. So lots of stuff to talk about today with our pundits. We'll begin on the Kansas side, and with us is Bob Beatty, who's a political scientist at Washburn University in Topeka. He joins us this morning from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. And Bob, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Joe Astrip is a political scientist at K-State. He joins us from his office in Manhattan. Joe, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And Dave Helling covers politics and government for the Kansas City Star. David, nice to have you, too.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with a story that Dave and I wrote for the newspaper on Sunday. We pointed out that Kansas's four-member congressional delegation to the U.S. House is the most conservative in the country, and it wasn't even close. Bob Beatty, how surprising was that to you?
Not very surprising at all when you look at Kansas politics since 2010.
Yeah.
What the congressional delegation from Kansas, all Republicans, have to look to now is the primaries. And what could moderate congressmen and congresswomen from Kansas would be a general election fight. But the way the politics have turned in Kansas now, there's a big fear of an attack from the right during a primary, and of course that then would push our delegation, the Kansas delegation, to the right. For example, 2 years ago, Lynn Jenkins had an incredibly underfunded and relatively unknown challenger from the legislature who challenged her in the primary from the right, and he got 42% of the vote.
Wow.
Without running any TV ads, without really running much of a campaign. And if that, you know, that's the kind of thing that's going to stick in the minds of the entire delegation.
Joe Astrip, what's behind this in your view?
Well, there's a couple of things that are behind it. First of all, we've seen the Republican Party, its primary constituency specifically. And when I talk about the primary constituency, I'm talking about the voters who turn out for a primary, which are traditionally, in both political parties, by the way, the individuals who are the most ideologically extreme, because mm-hmm. they're the ones who traditionally have more vested in a particular position and feel more strongly about the, you know, politics in general and their proposed solutions. And so in the case of the Kansas Republican primary constituency, which is a very fairly large size constituency, it has been trending to the right for the past really since the Reagan years. And what I'm talking about there is that the individuals have been becoming more extreme, more strident in their particular positions regarding things like abortion and taxes and a wide variety of other different things. They insist upon litmus tests for their candidates, that mm-hmm. is, you have to absolutely be against abortion, you have to be absolutely against any type of tax increase. And then on top of that, they then look at candidates and they look to see how pure they are in terms of matching up against those litmus tests. And the combination of all these things has created a situation where the more conservative of our candidates end up winning. And when the moderates do win, they typically had done so by moving as far and as fast to the right as they possibly can, and that would include Senator Jerry Moran, who ran against Todd Tehart a couple of years ago and ended up winning that primary vote, but did so very narrowly and did so by moving to the far right. Hmm. We also saw that with Lynn Jenkins, mm-hmm. who ran the same type of campaign, ran as the more moderate of the two candidates compared to Jim Ryan in 2008, but she also ran hard and fast to the right. And so it's one of those things where even the more moderate of our Republican candidates have been moving to the far right in order to satisfy these litmus tests.
You know, Dave Helling, it seems to me the thing about this is it didn't used to be this way. I mean, in Kansas, during the days of Bob Dole and Nancy Kassebaum, that wasn't all that long ago, was it?
No, and even more recently, Bill Graves is the governor, the classic moderate. And not only was Graves moderate in the Republican Party, but of course crushed David Miller, who was his primary opponent. You know, we've been talking a little bit about this dynamic of a primary challenge. As recently as 10 or 15 years ago, Steve, moderates still held sway statewide in Kansas. But I think the point of our story goes beyond just the congressional delegation, which, by the way, was based on votes, not necessarily public statements, but how these guys and women are voting in Washington. And that, to me, suggests that not only are they sort of talking the talk, but they're walking the walk in terms of conservative positions. But I think arguably Kansas, in its elected offices, top to bottom, is the most conservative. Certainly it's been in my lifetime. And when you look at Sam Brownback as governor, the legislature dominated by conservatives, Chris Kobach, who is a nationally ascendant as a conservative, and then the congressional delegation, both Senate and House. And so the interesting political story is not really between Republicans and Democrats in Kansas at all. It's between moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans, which we're seeing play out now in Topeka and other places. And that's the real – as we've talked about on this show before, that's the real important dynamic politically in the state today.
You know, Bob Baby, what I wonder about is that none of these members of Congress have drawn serious opposition this time around either. And I'm wondering if we're looking at something – you know, something of a permanent realignment in Kansas, given that.
Yeah, when reading the Kansas City Star story, I noted the amount of money that all four of the congressional delegation had in the bank, which is
big money.
Was going to scare away opponents. But it's an interesting point about the realignment. What's going on in Kansas is party identification is so powerful in Kansas. And as Dave mentioned, moderate Republicans in the last, you know, so many years, certainly since the Mike Hayden days of the late 80s, early 90s, think that, well, this is just going to, you know, this is going to blow over. And you see a moderate Republican, you know, maybe switch parties, but you don't see it happen in party identification. And when you talk to moderate Republicans, you know, they'll say, well, my parents were Republican, or I can't imagine switching parties, or sometimes even I can't imagine being unaffiliated. And so you talk about a realignment. At some point, the moderate Republicans may have to consider a realignment themselves. Switching to Democrat seems, you know, very, very difficult for them. But certainly it looks like if Kansas is going to have competitive two-party elections, there at some point may have to be a second party, and it may not be the Democrats.
Yeah. You know, we try to point out in our story, Joe Astrup, that all of this goes beyond just votes. There might be some real consequences to this, this realignment, this shift to the right when it comes to federal money coming to Kansas. You know, right in your backyard, for instance, is this big MBAF project, the National Biodefense Laboratory proposed for the K-State campus, proposed for Manhattan. It's a plan that would really change Manhattan in some significant ways. Lots of new jobs, lots of people coming to Manhattan to work. And yet, because of this conservative switch in Kansas, MBAF is very much sort of teetering on the brink of not being funded at all. What do you know about that? What can you tell us about that as you look at it there?
Well, you know, the MBAF story is a complicated one, and I'm not quite sure we can easily put it within this kind of conservative to moderate continuum in terms of because with MBAF, you know, you have a combination of states like Texas that did not get the funding and are still upset, and so the Texas delegation is actually ganging up on Kansas. You also have a situation whereby the Senate Democrats, have not been very, congenial towards funding MBAF. And whereas the Kansas delegation, which are conservative and Republican, have been highly supportive of MBAF, because they're in favor of cutting everybody else, they've not received very much sympathy from, particularly from Democrats on the other side of the aisle. And so it's very tough for them to get a coalition to kind of support the funding of MBAF. And so it's a combination of different things that really kind of all come together to hurt MBAF. But really, kind of if you think about that the policy implications, it really is very big in places like the 1st Congressional District, where the Farm Bill is currently being debated. And those subsidies to farmers make up a good part of the kind of the profit margin that farmers have enjoyed over the that farmers have had, if any, or made it so that they could even break even in the past. And so and it makes up a good part of actually the economy of the First District, like about one-fifth of it. And so you're talking about a pretty big impact, because the First District is a net importer of federal dollars, not an exporter of federal dollars, but an importer. And it has one of the most conservative members of Congress out there that is talking about cutting funding for the vast majority of federal programs. And so you're talking about some real policy impact for a large portion of Kansas, which the First District does cover.
But Dave Helling, you did come across in your own reporting some idea here that the First District Representative Tim Huell's camp, and whether he will wind up representing Manhattan as a result of this congressional redistricting process now underway in Kansas, might have some real impact on MBAF.
You can talk privately with Republicans, moderate and to some degree even conservatives, who are quite nervous about Tim Huell's camp, primarily because, and I think Bob and Joe can talk about this a little bit too, Huell's camp is not only Tea Party Republican, but he's very vocally Tea Party Republican. He's a freshman. He's often challenged the leadership of the Republican House. He voted against the debt ceiling, for example. And while all of that is defensible, and it's clearly a conservative viewpoint that Tim has, if you make the leadership angry over a series of votes, it can cost you some benefits from that leadership, including membership on the Agriculture Committee. And other things that the House Republicans might do to make Tim sort of fall in line more often. For example, Joe just talked a little bit about the Farm Bill. A lot of people don't know that the Farm Bill includes spending for food stamps, the food stamp program, supplemental nutrition, I think they call it now. And Tim Huell's camp has been very vocal about the need to cut funding for food stamps and the whole Republican line that, you know, Barack Obama is the food stamp president. Well, all of that is well and good. But if you cut food stamps at the legislative level, you will lose Democratic votes for the Farm Bill, and so indirectly could hurt farmers in his first district, not because of the pressure on farm subsidies, but because of the related issue over food stamps in the bill itself. Those are the kinds of calculations that congressmen and women make all of the time. And members like Tim Huell's camp are saying, in essence, we're not going to make those deals. Enough is enough. We're pure. We're right down the line. And that sort of bank shot could end up directly affecting his constituents. And Republicans will tell you that. They're nervous about it.
We're talking politics this morning with our political pundits. We're talking about the Kansas side, the ongoing Kansas legislative session, as well as a story we did on Sunday talking about just how conservative Kansas's congressional delegation is. We're visiting with Bob Beatty from Washburn, Joe Acert from K-State, and Dave Helling from The Star. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page.
Let me just throw this in very quickly. Another example of where this has a policy impact. Last year, Governor Brownback turned down a $35 million federal grant to begin preparing the health care exchanges that are part of the health care law. That kind of decision to turn down that kind of federal money would have been unthinkable to Bill Graves or Kathleen Sebelius or Mike Hayden or any other governor in the state of Kansas. Regardless of how you feel about the implementation of the health care bill, very controversial, of course, the fact is that if it is upheld by the court, states will have to have exchanges or the federal government will do it for them. And turning down that grant could have a significant impact on how prepared Kansas is to implement that law if and when it takes effect.
You know, Bob Beatty from Washburn, conservatives don't just claim the four members of the U.S. House. You know, just how conservative, in your view, is the Brownback administration and the legislature itself, for that matter, Bob, these days? What are you picking up?
Well, Steve, let me make a quick point about Healdskamp, and what it looks like is that he's cultivating a national constituency, which, you know, a number of politicians do when they get to Washington. He's very prominent on conservative talk radio, although he doesn't limit himself to conservative talk radio. He can be seen on MSNBC, which is more affiliated with the left. But if he's cultivating a national constituency outside of the party, then there will be some interesting decisions down the road, because if you're cultivating a national constituency, you have to be consistent. And it's hard to be necessarily consistent when you also have to look out for the interest of your district at times.
Yeah.
Sam Brownback and his administration, just by his record, he is the most conservative Kansas governor, at least in the last 50 years from what I've studied. As we all know, most Kansas governors, all Kansas governors in the last 50 years have been relatively conservative, relatively moderate, including many Democrats. Now, whether in their heart they were as moderate as they showed, they knew they had to be moderate. But also Republicans have been moderate. So Kansans voted in 2010 for a conservative governor, and he's been conservative. And the key, and I don't want to jump the gun here, is really what happens with A, redistricting in terms of the Kansas Senate, and then B, then the primaries. Because while the Brownback administration has been conservative and pushing various policies, if the Kansas Senate goes like the Kansas House and like the governor's office, then Kansas would be possibly by itself in terms of a conservative state that has not – Kansas may not have seen ever, but also in the United States, because they would be implementing some ideas that I think the Brownback administration wants to be the first and only state to show the rest of the nation that certain things they believe can work.
Hmm. So pretty conservative stuff, Bob, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote my column Sunday, Joe, that we're at an enormously consequential moment in Kansas with a wrap-up session going on in Topeka this week. It's consequential because conservative lawmakers are trying to place this enduring stamp on the state. How do you see this wrap-up session playing out, Joe, and how important is it to Sam Brownback's political future?
I think I would say that the wrap-up session is probably the last stand of the moderate Republicans. I think that we're talking about the end of an era when it comes to moderate Republicans. It may be at the end of this session that a lot of Republican Sam Brownback's key legislative proposals don't necessarily make it through the wash, so to speak. So we probably won't see anything when it comes to dealing with the Kansas public retirement system. We may not see anything when it comes to school reform. But we will see something on taxes. I mean, I think that at least that will get through. But I think more importantly, what we're seeing here is really the last gasp, if you will, of the Republican moderates. We saw the traditional Republican majority kind of pop out in terms of traditional Republicans for common sense. This was 50 or so former legislators, and I think the emphasis has to be on former.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are older. All of them were former office holders, and that's the problem for the moderates, is that the younger cohort of Republican office holders are more along the lines of Tea Party adherents. They're much more conservative, whereas the older office holders, which are a generation that is going out, if you will, because of just generational replacement, are much more moderate. And I think that we're going to see that trend continuing in the Republican primary, whereby the moderates are replaced by conservatives. It won't take a lot in order to shift the Senate over to a more conservative tilt. And so I think we really are at a crossroads in Kansas politics. We really are at a point in time where next legislative session, this could be the chance for conservatives to really put their mark on Kansas, to really undo a lot of the handiwork of these moderate Republican governors that have been in charge for the past 50 years.
And can I just throw in very quickly, we should not let the Democratic Party off the hook in Kansas. We've talked a lot about the split in the Republican ranks. But the reality is that one of the reasons for this trend is that the Democrats have been impotent in the state of Kansas. They're not,
yes, they are.
Not just at the top levels for House seats. And I mean, it's possible that none of the four members of the Kansas House delegation will face anything remotely like serious Democratic opposition in November. Certainly no one is rising up to face Sam Brownback if he seeks reelection. The Democrats are not proposing candidates, good quality candidates for state House, state Senate races. The Democratic Party in Kansas has clearly imploded, Steve. And because of that, the Republicans are sort of fighting amongst themselves. But at the end of the day, they're going to have the votes to do the things that Joe and Bob have talked about. And to some degree, at least, the Democratic Party is to blame for that.
And Dave, you're absolutely right. I mean, what you saw was the 6 years of the Kathleen Sebelius administration, where we saw individuals like Parkinson, who should have been a person that was in wait, sitting there waiting to take his turn in terms of running for governor, even against Sam Brownback, didn't take his turn. And then you have more the whole Morrison mess, whereby who was, if you will, the caricature of almost the perfect Democrat, right? I mean, he looked like the Marlboro man, you know, who rides a motorcycle, except for the fact that he just, you know, he has problems with women.
But Joe, don't you think one of the problems for the Kansas Democratic Party is that they were hanging their hopes on guys like Mark Parkinson, who, after all, was a Republican?
Right.
And Paul Morrison, who obviously had his own problems. I mean, Kansas, any political party needs to build a long-standing structure of new blood that sort of feeds into the older races. And the Democrats, it seems to me, arguably in Kansas, have completely abandoned that model and sort of hoping for some savior, and that's a problem for them.
Well, again, you know, part of it, though, just one last thing, Dave. Part of it is when you have such a small minority to begin with, that your margins for error are extremely small. And so, Sebelius you got to remember, when Sebelius came into office, she was one of the only Democratic office holders in that time frame. So the bench wasn't long to begin with.
Right, but you've had Jim Slattery in this state, Dan Glickman in this state, who declined to run for a Senate seat. I mean, Dennis Moore didn't put anyone in place to replace him in the third. Democrats in Kansas keep hoping for some savior of personality or accident of demographics to help them, rather than build their party from the ground up, it seems to me. And you see that failure in 2012.
Bob, hop in here.
Well, I mean, much of politics is you know, we know there's a charisma factor in politics. Of course there is. There's an X factor. And I see it in students. If you have a charisma and you see yourself as a future in politics, and you're a Democrat, you're probably going to leave Kansas.
Yeah.
If you're not that ideologically driven, you're a Republican at age 18. Bob Dole, in his autobiography, said he looked at party registration, and that was a major factor when he decided to become a Republican. I think the experience, again, party identification is so important in Kansas. The experience of Nancy Boida was, I think, very depressing for many Democrats in the state of Kansas. She worked her tail off to do what she was told you're supposed to do in Congress, which is take care of your district, not be too ideologically driven, come back all the time.
And she was out in 2 years, yeah.
And she was out in 2 years. She did everything she thought she was told she was supposed to do as a Democrat, meaning don't be too much of a Democrat. And I would argue that she probably wasn't. And she's now a pastor at a small church in Lecompton. Hmm.
We're talking politics with our political pundits. Let's go to some phone calls here. Sue from Kansas City, Missouri. Sue, good morning.
Hi. I just want to comment that this has been going on with Republicans for long ages. In 1992, a friend of mine in Olathe was running for a very progressive Democrat, was running for state rep against a very conservative Republican. You might remember Kay O'Connor. Mm-hmm. And I would go door to door and tell people, well, Betty is, supports this and supports this and supports this. And they would say, yes, I support that. I say, can Betty count on your vote? Oh, no, she's a Democrat. I can only vote for Republicans. So, even when people, people supported their issues, they just had to vote the party line.
Sue, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go to Dale from Kansas City, Kansas. Dale, you're on Up to Date.
Okay. I was found it interesting because I had moved in the state about 20 years ago. And Kansas used to be, I can remember there was a time when they were considered to be a pretty liberal state before I was born. And I'm not a young man anymore. And I've just kind of marveled at the change in the extreme right. And I think that that's going to eventually bite the extremists on the nose, because even the public will wake up to some of the things that's going on. But what really gets me is I participated in a conversation with our local representative here in Kansas City, national rep, and I was the generalities, the lack of specificity, what was going to be the impact of some of the actions that he and others of his thought are, what's going to be the impact upon the general public here in Kansas. And the constituents, they aren't asking for specifics. They're thinking, go where everybody else's cow and, don't bother mine. And when I was heard you talking about farmers, my father farmed. I grew up on a farm. And I've just found it fascinating that all these decades, farmers, particularly large corporate farmers, were more than eager to take what some people could honestly call maybe welfare.
Yeah. Well, Dave, this notion of politicians not being specific, hardly a new one in American politics.
Right, but I think the point we're trying to make in this conversation today is if that kind of attitude about cutting everyone except my constituents was limited to just one or two members of the Kansas legislature or the Kansas House, that would be understandable. But what we're talking about is a systemic, long-term, important fundamental change in the politics of this state. The caller is right. Kansas for years has been seen as one of the hotbeds of progressive Republicanism. You know, it's no accident that Teddy Roosevelt delivered his speech, his populist speech in Osawatomie, because Kansas, one of the first states to give women the vote, for example. So historically, over the last century, Kansas was considered fairly progressive in its Republicanism. And that has changed dramatically, fundamentally, for a long time. And it will profoundly affect the way we live in the state of Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a trend that we should pay some attention to, I think we're trying to argue. It isn't limited to one or two House members, the governor, a couple of people in the state legislature. It is systemic. It is government-wide in the state of Kansas, from local governments to states to national representatives, and it will change the way Kansas is run.
You know, Joe Astrup, given all this, today in the state of Indiana, there's an important election on the future of a long-term U.S. senator there, Richard Lugar. And Dick Lugar, I'm just sort of wondering, he's being challenged by a very conservative Republican in his own party. And you look back here in Kansas and you wonder about someone like Pat Roberts, a veteran member of Congress, very much like Dick Lugar. Might he be in trouble a couple years down the road when he has said he wants to seek re-election himself?
Well, you know, he could be in trouble. There are certainly individuals like, let's say, a Tim Huelskamp that I think Bob Beatty has correctly identified as somebody trying to create a national constituency in the national name, quite apart from just simply being a Republican House member, and who may be ambitious and may be thinking about taking a run at people at Roberts. On the other hand, Roberts is like Lugar, is a long-term stalwart, and there may be just enough respect for Roberts that if he decides to run, and by the way, he hasn't made a decision yet, if he decides to run, that they'll give him enough rope, if you will, to let him run and keep his seat and not face a challenge from the right. It's hard to say right now, but certainly right, if you look at the trends in the Republican Party, and you look at Lugar, or you look at what took place in a place like Utah a couple years back, you can see whereby kind of long-term traditional Republicans that came out of that more progressive wing that Dave Helling was talking about, who may have even been very conservative in their own votes over the past even 5 to 10 years, maybe just aren't pure enough for in terms of what the new Republican Party expects.
Do you think he's in trouble, Dave Helling?
Pat Roberts?
Yes.
I think Pat Roberts' biggest problem will not be his brand of Republicanism, but his age and his tenure in Congress. He's been there since 1980. I think one of the things that's getting Dick Lugar in Indiana is that he's been around so long. And you do get a sense that voters of both parties, but particularly, again, conservative, quote-unquote, Tea Party Republicans, are very biased against long-term members of Congress in the Senate and the House. In that sense, I think Pat Roberts could be in trouble. He's been there for a long time. But, you know, he can raise a lot of money. He's still fairly popular in the state. It's hard to see whether it would be Huelskamp, Yoder, Pompeo. Maybe they all have some designs on
Kobach.
That seat. Chris Kobach is a wild card. So it's arguable that all of those Republicans might want to wait for the next opportunity against – certainly this would be Pat Roberts' last term, so they would have another shot 4, 6, 10 years down the road.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I did an interview a while back for CQ, and I have to tell you, I don't place it as a – I don't put him in a high-risk category. Mm-hmm. Is he at risk? Yes. But I don't see Roberts as being in a high-risk category.
Yeah, I got you. I want to thank Joe Astrup and Bob Beatty both for taking time with us today to talk about Kansas politics. Joe, I sure appreciate it. Always do.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You bet. That's Joe Astrup, a political scientist at K-State, and Bob Beatty, a political scientist at Washburn U over in Topeka. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll turn to the Missouri side. We'll talk about Claire McCaskill, very much, many people say, in trouble in Missouri, looking for a re-election this year against three Republicans. And we'll also talk about a governor named Jay Nixon, who seems to be on a glide path towards re-election. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk yesterday with journalist and author Anna Quinlan, you'll find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the obstacles women of color face in their quest for equality. Well, this hour we're talking with our political pundits about all things politics in Kansas and Missouri. We're going to flip over now to the Missouri side. A lackluster legislative session got an unexpected dose of attention last week when a Republican lawmaker, Zach Wyatt, announced that he was gay, and he did it to oppose a bill aimed at restricting discussion and sexual orientation in public schools. Also, we'll talk about the U.S. Senate race for the seat now held by Claire McCaskill, which is very much picking up steam. Joining us now is George Conner. He's a political scientist at Missouri State University in Springfield. George, it's always good to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And Dave Helling from The Star is still here. George, I'm having a hard time finding anything too significant happening in Jeff City this year. How are you seeing it?
It's been a tough year. It's really heated up this week with the budget battle. I mean, they have to pass a budget by Friday, but it seems that we have folks coming out of the woodwork to stall that process. And one of the interesting things seems to be there's an awful lot of people who won't be there next year. They don't have a Jason Crowell or Jane Cunningham proposing amendments and conducting filibusters in the Senate side, but they're not going to be back next year. So I think maybe they don't have anything to lose at this point.
Now, what about Dave Helling, State Representative Zach Wyatt, who protested a bill aimed at restricting discussion of sexual orientation in public schools by announcing that he was gay? That happened last week. That seemed to catch people by surprise. How big a deal was that in your view?
Well, it took a great deal of personal courage for the representative who, by the way,
is the only Republican in the country, right. I think, a state legislator to be openly gay.
Right,
now.
Although he isn't running for re-election. So, but nevertheless, on a personal level, it takes a great deal of courage, obviously, to come forward in that circumstance. To me, it was indicative but his coming forward was not as important to me as the debate over the don't talk about homosexuality in the classroom anyway, which on its merits, we could argue about that all day. But it's indicative to me of a political problem in Missouri, which is that the legislature spends an inordinate amount of time on bills of symbolic importance, measures of symbolic import, but not substantive in terms of the challenges the state faces. The House passed a bill earlier in the session that would criminalize or impose criminal penalties on anyone who enforced the health care law, Obamacare. Again, the merits of Obamacare aside, is that really what our legislators should be spending their time on when, as George points out, we still don't have a budget about 96 hours before the deadline? As I've suggested in other places, the better strategy might be to deal with those issues first, and then if you have time left over, deal with things like guns and abortion and health care and that type of thing. Missouri seems to be taking the opposite tack.
If our listeners want to chime in about all things Claire McCaskill, Governor Jay Nixon, what do you think of their performance so far? What do you think of their challengers moving forward from the Republican side? 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Or again, go to KCUR's Facebook page. George, the House just passed a bill that would bar seniority from playing a role in Missouri teacher layoffs. School districts forced to reduce staff because of declining student enrollment, reorganization, or financial problems no longer would be banned from laying off a tenured teacher while keeping staff members who have not yet earned tenure protections. That's a strike at organized labor pretty directly, isn't it, George?
I think it is, and I think it piggybacks a little bit on what Dave said. It's not that there isn't a debate over the merits of tenure and seniority in the process, but this is certainly a Democratic versus Republican issue, and more specifically an urban versus outstate Missouri issue. And I think it plays into what Dave was talking about in the sense of making political statements more than deciding policy. Mm-hmm. I do think it's a blow to labor, but I'm not sure that this isn't a political issue. I'm running for office. I'm running for higher office more than it is a substantive policy decision.
Yeah, let me give you, for example, on schools, it's perfectly, as George suggests, in my view, fine to debate whether tenure should be a qualification for retaining teachers or not. But the Missouri legislature hasn't fully funded the school finance formula for many years. It still hasn't figured out what to do with governance in Kansas City and St. Louis. There are a whole host of substantial school-related issues that the legislature has more or less punted on. So why go to this?
Yeah.
Tackle your tough problems, and then if there's time left, deal with these more symbolic things. That's the argument I try to make. Anyway.
Again, for our listeners, would you vote to reelect Claire McCaskill? Would you vote to reelect Jay Nixon or Chris Koster, the Attorney General of the state? 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here. Ken from Lee Summit. Ken, you're on the program. Good morning. Are you there, Ken? Okay, let's move on to the big race for the U.S. Senate now going on. There are three Republicans, Todd Akin, Sarah Steelman, and John Bruner, all vying for the GOP nomination. Let's just begin with a basic question here, George Conner. Is Senator Claire McCaskill in political trouble or not? What's your take?
Well, I think you have to say she's in trouble, and there's probably at least three reasons. The first is the growing conservatism ideologically in the state of Missouri. I mean, we went for John McCain when everybody else was going for President Obama, and I don't think you can ignore that that's a different dynamic than when she ran the first time. The second thing is there's an eroding Democratic base, especially on the St. Louis side. I mean, there's part politics in the loss of the Carnahan congressional district, but it's really the issue that the district that was solidly Democrat when Dick Gephardt held it is no longer solidly Democratic. And so an area of the state that could be counted on to vote Democratic, it just can't be counted on there. The numbers are declining from when she ran the last time. And I think the last thing, we'll call it the Robin Carnahan effect. I mean, the Republicans are going to pair Claire McCaskill. We're already seeing it with President Obama, and he is not popular in the state of Missouri statewide. And I think these are three very difficult problems that she's going to have to overcome.
David?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah. I would add this. I think Claire McCaskill's biggest challenge in some ways is in Missouri is similar to what Barack Obama faces nationally, and that is that the electorate may reach a point where it decides that it opposes either Obama or McCaskill just because they're Democrats and the opponent doesn't really matter. I mean, you have to beat somebody with somebody is one of the oldest saws in politics, and to that extent, the Republican field in the Senate race has not exactly sparkled to date. But there may reach a point in Missouri where people say, in essence, Steve, I don't care who's running against her, we need a change, and I will vote for whoever that change will be. That, to me, is the central dilemma that Barack Obama faces, because I think a lot of Democrats are sort of hanging their hat on Mitt Romney, and people won't like him, and he's changed his views, and he's a millionaire, and he ran Bain Capital. And all of that works to a certain point. But if the economy doesn't improve, there may be a point where the electorate will say, I don't care about whether it's Mitt Romney or whoever. I just don't like Barack Obama. And I think that is his biggest problem, and a similar problem faces Claire McCaskill in November.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Susan from Kansas City North, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Hell yes, I'm voting for Claire McCaskill.
How come, Susan?
She is one of the few politicians that has been up front the whole time. She has said from the beginning she wasn't going to engage in pork barrel spending, and she didn't, which riled up many of her Democratic colleagues, including our former mayor, who I like a lot, but sorry, we got to do something. She also supports veterans and puts her money where her mouth is. And I really admire her honesty. And if people go back and look at her campaign and look at her record, if they take the time to do that, I think that they will be more favorably impressed. That's my comment. My question is, when do you guys remember our parties being so divisive? Because in my studies, I can't remember any time being so divisive until just prior to the Civil War.
When researching our story on the Kansas House delegation, there are some empirical studies of voting patterns in the House and the Senate, which suggests that this is the most divided the Congress has been in 150 years. George, I don't know if you've seen those
studies. So that would be
studies.
The Civil War.
Yeah. There's no question.
That's great.
Now, you know, diagnosing the problem is easy. Figuring out a cure is much more difficult. And again, George, you may have some thoughts on that or may have seen some of those studies.
George, can you fix this, George, this entrenched bipartisanship we're seeing in Washington right now?
Well, it's hard to fix the entrenched partisanship in Washington. You know, ultimately we can say it's the voters' responsibility. But
amen.
You know, the candidates play to their, and in the congressional level, it's that small district in Kansas City or that small district here in Southwest Missouri, and you continue to play to that audience and ignore the larger audience, which really suggests that you should compromise. I mean, you think about the senators who bailed Warren Rudman. You know, he just couldn't take the partisanship anymore. I mean, ultimately, as long as House members and senators play to the constituency back home for their reelection purposes, they tend to ignore the bigger picture that mandates compromise.
Yeah, or there is no incentive to compromise. Voters don't reward compromise. You don't ascend in the leadership if you compromise, and you certainly don't end up on Fox News or MSNBC if you're seen as a compromiser. And I think as we drive sort of middle-of-the-road compromisers out of our politics, we shouldn't be surprised that it becomes so polarized.
I was going to say, speaking of that, George Conner, Claire McCaskill is what Dave Helling just said. She very much is in the middle of those National Journal rankings that rank members of the Senate from most liberal to most conservative. She's almost smack dab in the middle. She's a centrist. And isn't that what Missouri is pretty much these days, George, or how do you see it?
Well, I think Missouri is probably farther right than Claire McCaskill is, but I think it's as Susan pointed out, if you look at her record, Claire McCaskill can distance herself from the president and you know the liberal politics of Democrats in Washington, but ultimately it's not her record so much as how she will be portrayed by whichever of her Republican opponents will be out there. I mean, Claire McCaskill is not a liberal Democrat by national standards, but ultimately it's that tie to President Obama that may make or break her campaign. I think Dave is right in that it's not so much what her record is, it's just that we're tired of Claire McCaskill, and it's going to be anybody but Claire.
George, who do you see coming out of this Republican primary scrum for the U.S. Senate? Again, John Bruner, Todd Akin, Sarah Steelman are the three candidates. Where do you see that going?
Well, it's a real tough call in so many ways. I think Congressman Akin and Sarah Steelman are shooting for the same audience in the sense that they're both trying to portray themselves as outsiders when, you know, in many ways they're both insiders. But, you know, in terms of ideology, in terms of their position on the issues, whether it's Obamacare, abortion, guns, and so on, they're really trying to target the exact same audience. And so ultimately they may split that vote. And Bruner arrives as the true outsider. Bruner comes out on top. Bruner has avoided, as a businessman, he seems to have avoided thus far the missteps that we've seen in the gubernatorial side with Mr. Spence. And then the Akin-Steelman split is also one that's sort of an outstate versus suburban Republican. Congressman Akin certainly has a very strong base in the St. Louis area with suburban Republicans. And Sarah Steelman, given her race against Kenny Hulsoff in the Republican primary a few years back, is very strong in southern southwest Missouri and creeping up into the Kansas City suburbs. And so I think there's an issue of population support. And again, they may split that difference with Bruner coming out ahead.
And if you're right, George, the interesting thing is that Missouri Republicans may nominate for the two top spots on the 2012 ballot businessmen who have no political experience in Dave Spence and John Bruner, both from the St. Louis area. That's a fascinating sort of strategy to take on, you know, guys like Jay Nixon or Claire McCaskill who have been around politics for 30 years.
Yeah, and it is interesting that they both come from St. Louis, but I think, as you guys would probably know, the Republicans that might normally run for office from the Kansas City side all live in Kansas. You know, because the Republican base that is West County, Chesterfield, St. Charles, St. Peters, all of those people are in Johnson County on the Kansas side, and so it's probably not surprising that the business folks that come out of the Republican Party are on the St. Louis side.
Mm. You know, we were talking a little bit ago about the do-nothing legislative session this year, George Conner. You know, last night the Senate was virtually shut down by Senator Jason Crowell from the Cape Girardeau area, and this funding for the Sue Scheer Institute over in St. Louis very much in jeopardy here. This is an institute that empowers women to run for political office and educate folks on all of that. George, how much in danger is this session from simply imploding right now?
Well, I think, you know, the Sue Scheer Institute, as the numbers separating Democrats and Republicans got closer and closer in the Missouri legislature, and then the Republicans took over both the House and the Senate, The Souchier Institute has gotten closer and closer to the center of the radar. But I think it goes back a little bit to what Dave was talking about at the very beginning. You know, we have some really serious problems in the state of Missouri, and defunding the Souchier Institute is probably not the biggest budgetary priority, but it's become a symbolic issue. Hmm. And the symbolism has gotten more and more important as the parties have, as the margin of the Republicans has gotten bigger, and the symbolic gesture, I really do think it's a symbolic gesture, especially with Senator Cunningham, you know, going out. I think that there were great danger of not coming up with a budget by the constitutional deadline of Friday.
You know, just briefly, what's this? What are your concerns going forward, Dave Helling, about Governor Jay Nixon's prospects? Is he in any trouble at all politically?
Doesn't seem like it to date. He's well funded. He's stayed out of the fights in the legislature. You might criticize him for the policy of that, but the politics have appeared to be pretty smart. You don't get the sense that Dave Spence is getting any traction. Again, George, you may disagree with that, but I don't feel that up here at all.
No, I agree completely. I mean, I think there's been the issue of traction. You know, it's been misstep after misstep for the Spence campaign. I mean, I think he'll run a credible campaign between now and November, but I don't think Governor Nixon is really in any danger. And I think for the most part, staying out of the legislative fray has been strategic. And I was a little bit surprised that the governor stepped in the Carnahan-Clay race on the other side. You know, because ordinarily the head of the governor as head of the party would stay out of a primary battle. So I found that a little bit surprising, but I don't think it in any way jeopardizes the reelection.
All right. Well, George, always a pleasure to have you and take some time with us, George. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here, Steve.
That's George Conner. He's a political scientist at Missouri State University and my pal and colleague from the Star, Dave Helling. David,
great
always
to be here.
Appreciate it very much. All right. You'll find more information about our program at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the obstacles women of color face in their quest for equality. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.